Hollywood Scandals is part of the Dark Hollywood Collection in the Reels Files on Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Be sure to subscribe for new episodes each Thursday. Then go to Reels.com, check the top of the screen, and enter your zip code to find out how you can watch more chilling cases like this when you watch TV. That's R-E-E-L-Z.com for the dark crime series and specials you'll find only on Reels Channel.
From the money comes the power. From the power comes the control, and then you can do just about whatever you want to.
They sell themselves as the best and brightest.
Let us go forth to lead the land we love.
The Kennedys, America's first family.
They were going to create what they created, a dynasty.
But pull back the curtain, and another portrait emerges.
These giant Kennedy men, they've got quite a rap sheet, the Kennedys.
Forged by a ruthless patriarch.
He always had a smile on his face, and yet behind it all, he was a devil.
Fueled by a pathological sense of entitlement.
Don't take responsibility. Figure out a way to get out of it.
My conduct make no sense to me at all.
For whom ordinary rules don't apply.
The 31-year-old accused of raping a 29-year-old woman.
She said, "You just raped me." And he said, "No one will believe you."
Because when you are a Kennedy, protecting a legacy is paramount, no matter the cost.
They had more drama than could fill 22 soap operas.
Family patriarch Joe Kennedy begins an affair with the silent film actress Gloria Swanson that will make Hollywood buzz. 2 years later, Joe is gone, and so too is Gloria's money. Like nearly all who deal with Joe, she should have read the fine print.
John! John!
They are a brand as famous as Levi's and Coca-Cola. The Kennedys, America's royal family.
Because of their glamour, their youth, they made America a certain kind of place that the world was just enamored with.
They had the smile. They had the looks. Ralph Lauren could not do as good of a job today.
But even as we see ourselves in them, they are not like us.
A strong response is clearly needed.
They are rulers.
United, there is little we cannot do.
Dangerously flawed.
I'm innocent.
Ruthless.
And I think we can do far better.
And incredibly rich. And from the contradiction between their public persona and their secret lives, scandal is born.
Those are very important qualities for politicians to have, to know how to sell yourself and create an image. The question is, what's behind it?
The story of the Kennedys is an epic tale, nearly a century in the making, and the origins of which begin not in Washington or even their native Massachusetts, but in Hollywood. 1926. Most come to Hollywood early in life to seek their fame and fortune. The 37-year-old Joe Kennedy arrives in his prime.
Forget all the movie stars and the directors and producers, graders. He was going to be the man.
To the East Coast investors who provide the movie studios with their financial lifeblood, Joe is the complete package. Handsome, charming, a seemingly self-made businessman with a growing family of children, considered by many to be a real American and someone they can trust.
I'm looking forward with great anticipation, taking up my duties here.
He was going to be this Christian in the Jewish-controlled movie business who came in and changed everything.
It was a lot of Jewish immigrants who had sort of stumbled into movie making, but they didn't know how to run a multi-million dollar integrated business. Joe referred to them as pants pressers.
He always had a smile on his face. That was a big key to his success. And yet, behind it all, he was a devil.
But the image that Joe sells to these investors is as full of illusion as images on the silver screen, and often obscures his more sinister intent.
Joe portrayed himself as someone who started from nothing, was highly religious. None of that was true.
The real Joe is born to the upper class in the Irish Catholic enclave of East Boston in 1888.
He was really well educated. He went to Harvard. His dad was a bank president.
Many of the Irish in Boston are poor and treated like second-class citizens, not Joe. But pretending to be a working-class hero bolsters his self-made image and allows Joe to rationalize his willingness to break the rules. If the system is rigged against him, the ends always justify his means.
He felt like he was a man apart that could do whatever he wanted.
After graduating Harvard, Joe got a job as a state bank examiner, and that gave him access to all kinds of inside information. And he used that unethically and often unlawfully. And that was one of his big keys to success.
For a wife, Joe pursues Rose Fitzgerald, the daughter of the politically tied former mayor of Boston.
Rose's father, Honey Fitzgerald, was a tremendous powerhouse, could introduce Joe to important people. You do wonder whether the marriage was all about acquiring power.
By 1925, Joe possesses the kind of political connections to become a mayor or congressman. But behind his spectacles and smile, Joe believes he's entitled to more, much more.
More than anything, he wanted to be the first Irish-American president. That was the goal. So how do you get there?
The answer is cash, and a lot more of it than Joe can amass from a Boston bank. So Joe begins to scour for opportunities to strike it rich.
He had a good friend, a financier, for various Hollywood movie studios and movie moguls. And when his friend went on vacation in Italy one time, Joe, who had access to his office, plundered the files, got all this inside information to position himself to start buying into movie companies and make a killing.
Inside the stolen files is the golden goose Joe has been seeking, an undervalued movie studio named the Film Booking Offices of America, also known as FBO. Joe buys himself the presidency of the studio, sending shockwaves through the film industry. No one before had come from Wall Street and bought the seat of power for themselves at a studio. He leaves Rose and his growing family behind and heads to Hollywood.
One of the best ways to make money was not just to make the movies, but to own the theaters.
He wanted to buy a chain owned by a Mr. Pantages, who owned the second largest movie chain in California. This guy did not want to sell out. Joe made an offer. He turned it down. So what did Joe do? He hired a young woman and her boyfriend to make up a claim that Pantages had tried to rape her. And Pantages was, in fact, convicted.
With his reputation ruined and his bank account drained, Pantages finally agrees to sell for half the initial offer. Joe takes full advantage of every business deal in order to maximize his profits and strengthen his resolve.
He was going to show the world he was better than everybody else. And that permeated every decision he made. But Pantages learned a great lesson. Don't cross Joe Kennedy.
By 1928, Joe heads three movie studios, an unmatched feat in the history of Hollywood. With his rivals cowering and his riches soaring, Joe seemingly has it all. But Joe doesn't just want to be Hollywood's most successful banker. He wants to be a star.
In Hollywood, Joe saw a combination of gullible people that he could hoodwink and also a lot of glamour. He loved pretty women, and Hollywood was full of them.
It started with chorus girls. It started with assistants and things like that. And then, of course, he went for the big fish, and that was Gloria Swanson.
Movie star Gloria Swanson is back in New York. Remember her in The Affairs of Anatole?
Actress, comedienne, stunning beauty. Gloria Swanson is America's most enticing fantasy, all in one. She has but a single flaw.
She was a terrible businesswoman, and she had these lavish spending habits that got her in financial trouble. Champagne, chauffeurs, butlers. I mean, she had a huge, sprawling mansion. So she was the perfect pick for Joe Kennedy.
Gloria was looking for financing for a movie and introduced herself, and then Joe began this seduction of her.
Joe learns that image is everything in Hollywood and decides to boost his own star power
by having an affair with one of the biggest actresses of the day, even if they both are married.
She said the first time she had sex with him, it was like a wild horse being let loose. Now, did he hide that from Rose? Did he hide it from anybody? No. And that was the stepping stone, moving him right up the ladder to where people were really going to take notice of Joe Kennedy.
Sex, power, and wealth all wrapped into one. With Gloria at his side, the press now seek him out, and he masters the art of media manipulation. His name is now always above the title.
He's going to use the same gimmicks, the same strategies, the same way of thinking when he gets into the political game. Joe learns that it's not so much who you are, it's what people think you are.
Mr. Joseph Kennedy is back on the job with a splendid appearance of optimism.
To keep Gloria happy, Joe showers her with mink coats and cars, while taking an even closer interest in the management of her millions.
She signed over all of these power of attorney things to Joe and his deputies. He created a company called Gloria Productions, which managed all of her sort of business portfolio.
He was going to restructure her debt. He was then going to finance her films. And she's also sleeping with him. Joe was not only her savior, he was going to help her make millions.
But in 1929, the stock market crashes. The world plunges into depression. Yet for Joe, who has enough insider information to sell high and buy low, couldn't have come at a better time.
He starts selling off his shares really quietly under other people's names so that no one knows he's selling. He makes a huge amount of money.
Because Joe was smart enough to get out of the market, some said by some manipulation. I think his quote was, "Well, it didn't affect me."
In 1930, just months after the crash, Joe liquidates all his Hollywood holdings for a profit and buys real estate and other assets that will soon establish him as one of the 20 richest men in the country.
He's one of the very few millionaires, maybe even billionaires, in the United States at the time. So he's enormously wealthy, and he makes out really well from his time in Hollywood.
Whatever it may be, he looked at life through a dollar sign, and it was always all about Joe.
Joe's got the money, but it's the power he wants. Never losing sight of his political ambitions, he leaves Hollywood and returns to the East Coast and to Rose and the children. And as for Gloria, it's time for Joe to cash out with her as well.
And he dumps her. And what happens? She's not getting any checks, and she can't understand why. She ends up looking into what happened with the production company, and Joe charged all of these things against that production company. Gloria Swanson was broke.
By 1935, Joe's wealth increases to the equivalent of $3.1 billion in today's dollars, giving him the kind of financial clout to be president.
I'm delighted to be here.
Combined with his newfound PR skills, Joe now appears invincible. Only one thing can stop this man who would be king, himself.
He would talk about Hitler as a great man and conspire with the ambassador to Germany to feed him inside information. It was just unbelievable.
January 1961. President John Fitzgerald Kennedy delivers his inaugural address.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Seated nearby is his father, Joseph P. Kennedy, for whom this moment is the culmination of nearly two decades of work. JFK may be the leader of the free world, but Joe is now the most powerful man. A decade after cashing out of Hollywood, Joe Kennedy watches as the Battle of Britain rages over London. 2 years earlier, he'd been appointed U.S. ambassador to England by President Franklin Roosevelt in exchange for large campaign contributions.
And as for me, I'm delighted to be here.
It's a stepping stone to the presidency, and he was all set. And then he went over to London and made a couple mistakes.
As much of London goes up in smoke, Joe is convinced England is lost, and he is deeply impressed by the German war machine and all that it represents.
Joe Kennedy was a very, very rabid anti-Semite. He would talk about Hitler as a great man. He would actually conspire with the ambassador to Germany to feed him inside information that might help Germany during the war. It was just unbelievable.
Well, that didn't go over too big with FDR, and he basically yanked him back to the United States and fired him.
Joe has always seen himself as a future president. But when his private views become public, including his endorsement of Hitler, it's a scandal from which there is no return. For the rest of his life, Joe Kennedy must operate in the shadows.
So now Joe says to himself, if I can't be president of the United States, one of my sons will.
Of the 9 Kennedy children, 4 are boys. Joe Jr., John, Robert, and the youngest, Ted. And each is created in their father's image.
They're basically a shadow of him. It's like little Joes running around.
There was no sense of rebellion or any deviation. As Jack later said, you know, in those days we didn't have opinions. It was all his father.
The plan is for Joe's oldest boy, Joe Jr., to become president. And knowing that fame comes from image making, Joe Jr. becomes a test pilot during World War II, volunteering for the most risky assignments. Like on the silver screen, war heroes make good leading men. But in Joe's vision, so too great political candidates.
One of the technicians warned him that the explosives could be triggered by almost any vibration. And Joe ignored that and went ahead, and they ignited, and he was killed.
When Joe died in the war, all those ambitions for Joe Jr. were transferred onto his son, John.
John, too, has nearly died in the war. On patrol in the Pacific, his PT boat 109 collides with a Japanese destroyer and sinks. At great risk, John saves the lives of several of his fellow sailors, earning him the Navy and Marine Corps Medal.
Now, Joe knew how to take advantage of these stories, and he arranged for Reader's Digest to do a big piece about how Jack had rescued these individuals. And that became the fulcrum for Jack's ascension into politics.
A Hollywood PR department couldn't have written the script any better. And Joe knows it. John, the handsome war hero, is a PR dream.
He would come in with the movie star looks. Every woman in the place either wanted to mother him, wanted to date him, or do something else.
Joe sets about not only creating a politician in his son, John, but also a star. Just like in Hollywood, every moment is now a potential photo op.
Joe Kennedy strongly valued the ability to use self-portraits of their family to burnish the image of the Kennedy brand. Those were done both out of actual love and affection, but also a very savvy, very cannily, cunningly crafted political message. It's always both.
Joe transforms events, like John's marriage to Jacqueline Bouvier in 1953, to the kind of easily digestible storybook romance that today's pop stars would fight for.
They really had an image that we were putting forth. It's not random by a long shot.
But the big difference between Joe's prior experience in Hollywood and now is the emergence of a new medium, television.
Our guest of the afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, will be Congressman John F. Kennedy of Boston, son of the former ambassador to England.
Joe quickly recognizes that TV is the ideal means to project the Kennedy mystique to the world.
Pleasure to have you here, and I want you to meet my daughter Caroline and my wife Jackie.
How do you do?
Kennedy had savvy media advisors, some with Hollywood connections. They could afford all the resources available to them, and they used them.
By emphasizing John's youthful energy, charm, and intellect, Joe and his PR machine create an intoxicating image for the rising baby boom generation. This is politics as Hollywood showbiz, and it's groundbreaking.
We are a great country, but I believe that we can be a greater country.
No television performance of John Kennedy's ever did anything but help him.
But only when the cameras stop does a more complex, elusive John Kennedy emerge. A man still wounded from the war and saddled with an increasing dependence on painkillers.
Kennedy really was not a well man. He was in pain a great deal of the time, took a great deal of medication, and yet we thought of him as a person of great vigor.
In the final months of the presidential campaign, the race remains tight. So according to many reports, Joe spreads his millions around, tipping the balance in key precincts.
We know that Joe Kennedy's money was critical to JFK's success in getting elected to Congress, the Senate, and ultimately the presidency in 1960.
In November 1960, Joe watches as his son, John Kennedy, is elected president.
Rather than paying a price for all of his deceit, Joe had the honor of sitting in the inauguration booths and watching Jack in the motorcade wave to him. What more could you want out of your life than to see your son become president?
In the weeks to follow, a special phone line is installed between the president and his father. John may have his finger on the button, but Joe now has his full fist on the presidency and the country.
The thing that's fascinating is that he had to be in the wings. He had to pretend in a way that he had no part of it.
But less than a year later, after the presidential inauguration, Joe Kennedy's line goes silent.
He had had a stroke and he was largely paralyzed. He could understand other people, but had a great deal of difficulty communicating.
For the rest of his life, Joe remains essentially silent. And without his firm control on the tiller, the dark lessons that he has instilled in his sons begin to spin out of control.
Marilyn Monroe.
Marilyn Monroe would be the Hollywood trophy for Jack Kennedy. Well, where'd he get the idea? From Joe Kennedy.
Following the rules of his father's own playbook, both publicly and privately, the notches in JFK's bedpost include starlets, a dangerous mobster's girlfriend, and his wife Jackie's virginal 19-year-old intern.
Two were secretaries who were referred to as fiddle and faddle, 24-year-old young women, and they would go swimming nude in the pool with Jack, and the Secret Service would try to make sure that Jackie never found out about this.
But it's not Jackie that the president needs to worry about. Rather, by late 1963, reports suggest his own sexual appetite is expanded to include call girls, professional escorts whose intentions and backgrounds are a risk. And in the months to come, one of them threatens to become a scandal so grave that it will ruin the Kennedys forever.
It's actually really quite breathtaking to think of some of the implications.
If you like what you're hearing, check out The Dark Side of Hollywood on Reel's channel. You'll find real stories of celebrity icons on Autopsy, like Anthony Bourdain and Aretha Franklin, whose lives were cut short, plus others whose lives were changed forever by fame. Reel's is also your go-to for real crime and chilling views into the minds of serial killers. Find Reel's on your TV at Reel's.com. That's R-E-E-L-Z.com. Then, check the top of the screen and enter your zip code to find Reels in your area.
Fall 1963. With the Cuban Missile Crisis behind them, the Kennedy administration is on the move, pressing forward on an agenda of civil rights, the space program, and preparing for the re-election campaign of 1964. All systems are go.
Let us go forth to lead the land we love.
But on a late October afternoon, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover arrives at the White House for a clandestine meeting with the Kennedys. At stake, the presidency itself.
It's actually really quite breathtaking to think of some of the implications.
The danger is a high-end call girl with Elizabeth Taylor looks and Linda Lovelace charms. Her name? Ellen Romach.
Kennedy had lots and lots of affairs. But this one is unique because she is from East Germany.
What worries Hoover isn't the sex. It's that Romach was born behind the Iron Curtain. He believes she is a communist spy.
Had President Kennedy had an affair with a communist spy, any number of classified secrets could be put at stake. He would at least be exposing himself to the danger of blackmail.
For the Kennedys, this is a moment of truth. Sexual conquests are considered a Kennedy birthright. Yet now, one woman could destroy everything.
Reports were beginning to come out about the existence of this sex scandal.
As the president and first lady leave for a quick stop in Dallas, the walls are closing in. But then, history intervenes. November 1963. In the aftermath of the assassination in Dallas, the country is in shock. The investigation into the Washington sex scandal, centering around JFK, evaporates. Ellen Romich is no more than a footnote in history. Only one headline can exist now.
The Kennedy brand would have been fixed in our imagination no matter what, but with the assassination, it's indelible for generations.
At the center of it all is Jackie, resolute, iconic. The funeral ceremonies and eternal flame, all her design.
There's no question that during the funeral, it's not President Lyndon Johnson. It is the outgoing First Lady, Jackie Kennedy, who really is the head of state in the symbolic and spiritual sense.
Some are born into history. Others have it thrust upon them. For Jackie, it's both. By the time she marries John Kennedy, Jackie is a well-bred, well-traveled beauty with a taste for high fashion and the figure to carry it off.
Her clothes were iconic. It added the sheen, the glamour, the royal kind of halo.
In many ways, their partnership, politically and aesthetically, is really, quite literally, a match made in heaven.
Even her voice possesses the soft, breathy whisper of a movie star.
It just seemed to me such a shame when we came here to find hardly anything of the past in the house.
But while Jackie may walk and talk like a silver screen ingenue, she is much more than she appears.
Jackie was also a show girl in the sense that she also would put on airs. She understood what the Kennedys were about. She understood how much smoke and mirrors were involved, and that was fine with her.
2 weeks after the president's funeral, Jackie leaves the White House and soon begins her own smoke and mirrors campaign. She knew of the adultery, the corruption, but she too bought into Joe Kennedy's mantra wholeheartedly: protect the brand and its assets at all costs. She does it with a single word: Camelot.
She said his favorite song was Camelot. They played it every night. No one else could remember that happening, but she talked about it quite a bit. Don't let it be forgot that once there was a spot for one brief shining moment that was known as Camelot. And she quoted that. And she said, but there never will be again.
She is intuitively aware that it's about closure of sorts for the country, but it's also about beginning to preserve that legacy, that myth, really, of the Kennedy presidency as Camelot.
The choice is a sappy one, invoking a magical time in which noble princes fight bravely for honor, country, and the women they love.
Jackie actually said, I'm not leaving his legacy to, she called them, the dusty historians. So she laid out the strategic template, week one, practically. And it really, if a brand is powerful enough, it can survive a lot of scandals.
But in time, those dusty historians begin to scale the Camelot walls. Obsessed with getting the truth about the assassination and the Kennedys, they begin to publish court secrets about Joe, the president, and even Jackie herself.
A person is going to have flaws, imperfections. That's part of why we love them. We kind of like to see our brand icons stumble so they can come back.
But from inside the Kennedy walls, the Camelot image is now sacred, and all those who seek to tarnish it, heretics.
There's no question that Jackie is going to police our understanding and our access to information about her deceased husband.
The myth of Camelot protects and empowers Jackie. But unlike Joe, who used his money to buy the press, she would use her will to crush it. And the Kennedy clan is with her. 1966. Jackie threatens to ruin journalist William Manchester and his publishers when they refuse to stop the release of Manchester's account of Dallas. 1968. Jackie breaks a long-standing alliance with the Washington Post over the publication of interviews with JFK. 1972, Jackie battles fabled photographer Ron Galella in a landmark privacy court case. With each year, the public's fascination with the Kennedys' private lives grows. And yet, with each inquiry, the family draws a tighter circle around it and themselves. They are in charge, and no one is allowed to question it.
When my book, The Sins of the Father, came out, the Kennedys actually went to the media and browbeat them to not pick up anything about this book.
And while initially Camelot will shield the family from controversy, the next generation of Kennedys will take its protection for granted. And that is a guarantee for scandal.
The document says she was physically tackled while she ran to escape.
She said, "You just raped me." And he said to her, "No one will believe you."
June 1968. Robert Kennedy, the heir apparent following JFK's death, is assassinated during a presidential campaign rally in Los Angeles. Of Joe's four boys, only one now remains, Teddy, the youngest. And for Ted, as for many of the Kennedys to follow, he may very nearly drown in it. Summer 1969. U.S. Senator Ted Kennedy is behind the wheel of an Oldsmobile as it skids off a bridge on the island of Chappaquiddick near Martha's Vineyard. Inside the car with Kennedy is the 24-year-old campaign volunteer, Mary Jo Kopechne.
He escaped from the submerged car and left Mary Jo Kopechne in there. Took him 10 hours to call the cops. The rest is scandal.
The investigation later reveals that Kennedy not only leaves the scene, but he also consults with at least two Kennedy insiders, then returns to his hotel and falls asleep. When two fishermen find the car and Mary Jo the following morning, the senator is again meeting with his advisors.
What I'm concerned with, and we have charged them with, is the time period after the accident, the leaving the scene.
Ted knew from Joe that you cover up these things, you don't deal honestly, and that's exactly what happened.
Had his name been Smith or Jones, the odds of significant criminal charges would be high.
This morning I entered a plea of guilty to the charge of leaving the scene of an accident.
At a minimum, his political career should be over. But Ted isn't just anybody. He's a Kennedy, the lone son carrying the torch of the brand.
My conduct and conversations during the next several hours, to the extent that I can remember them, make no sense to me at all.
All the family advisors got together after this, and they did everything they could to save his political career.
Apology to the nation evokes sympathy.
We feel that he is human. People do make mistakes, and it's very difficult. We're in a quandary, really.
I voted for him in the past, and I'd vote for him again.
Camelot, more powerful than reason. Or some say, justice.
Senator Kennedy's suspended sentence was granted on the basis of his character and his worldwide reputation.
Leaving the scene of a fatal accident, which he caused, the guy escaped with a misdemeanor.
I think Ted is influenced by the poison that Joe Kennedy permeated among that family. Their decisions based on that absolute feeling that they are immune from any consequences to their actions. And William Kennedy Smith, why wouldn't a woman want to be with me? I'm a Kennedy, and I'm going to go ahead and do what I want to.
Easter weekend, 1991. They once called it the Winter White House, the Kennedy compound, Palm Beach, Florida, where generations of Kennedys have frolicked, believing themselves immune to ordinary standards. But nothing lasts forever.
The state attorney's office filed a two-count criminal information today charging William Kennedy Smith with violations of the Florida law.
The 31-year-old accused of raping a 29-year-old woman at the Kennedy family estate. If convicted of these charges, a person could face 15 years in prison.
I'll be found innocent of all the charges.
Only two people know exactly what happened that night. Patricia Bowman, the alleged victim, and William Kennedy Smith, nephew of both Ted Kennedy and the late President JFK. But what is clear is that in the hours after the alleged incident, Bowman is traumatized.
She called her friend Ann Mercer, who had been dining with her earlier that night, and she said, "Help me."
She was, you know, in disarray and very upset, went immediately to the police and reported what had happened.
The document says she was physically tackled while she ran to escape. Photographs showed bruising on her legs, shoulders, and arms, according to the affidavit.
And what was even more interesting is that Patricia Bowman had taken two polygraphs and passed them. Very unusual in a forensic setting.
In the days that follow, pandemonium erupts as the press swarms the Palm Beach enclave. Gone are the days when Joe's money could keep a lid on things.
Investigators were told by persons at the Kennedy estate the day after the alleged attack that they had just missed Senator Edward Kennedy and his nephew.
I was not told, never was told, that the Palm Beach police wanted to speak to me.
My family's on trial for me, and in some strange way, I'm on trial for my family.
But those who predict the trial marks an end to the Kennedys underestimate the power of the brand and the men and women behind it. Not only do they circle the wagons, they fire back.
They had a whole press operation that tried to influence what the coverage was like.
Newly hired image makers have played up Will Smith the dog lover, warm, likable, and friendly.
Every image is tightly controlled. Every moment in public, a potential photo op.
Rather than having the chauffeurs and the limos, they drove up in the station wagon or nondescript rental cars. They know that everyone is watching their every step.
Every member of the family did a turn in the audience in the courtroom, very publicly showing support.
John F. Kennedy Jr., once voted the sexiest man alive, is now thrilling crowds at the Palm Beach courthouse.
My first reaction when I saw John, I thought they're bringing in the big guns.
When it comes time for Ted Kennedy to take the stand, he reveals just how powerfully the Kennedy brand can be brought to bear.
Will's father, he was very special to me. He was an extra brother, really. We lost a brother in the war. When Gene married Steve, we had another brother.
A lot of his testimony had to do with his sense of grief over the loss of his brothers.
He was with my brother when he was killed.
That night, he needed some companionship because he was depressed and was thinking about the tragedies in his family. So, good Lord, I mean, that's just like pulling on the national heartstrings.
This is the full force of a century of Kennedy history barreling down the tracks. And this jury, like perhaps any jury, can do nothing but relent.
Not a lot of people were surprised that William Kennedy Smith was found not guilty. As a matter of fact, at the end of the trial, when he walked out of the courtroom, he was greeted with the cheers and support of thousands of people. Thousands of people who still believed in Camelot.
The not guilty verdict demonstrates that the Kennedy brand still resonates. But to many, the cracks begin to show, revealing a family out of touch and out for themselves. The clock is ticking on the family legacy. Only one member still seems to inspire the hope of Camelot.
Carolyn, look this way, John.
It was massive, and that was nothing Carolyn signed on for.
He is among the most famous men in the world. For his name, for his dashing good looks, and of course, the photo.
There's probably more interest in this gentleman than any other person in this country, and probably with good thinking.
When I first met John Kennedy Jr., it's like you don't know what to say, how to act, the way he speaks, the way he carries himself. It throws you off your game.
Don't really care to speculate on that.
As a boy, John's mother, Jackie, does everything she can to shield him from media scrutiny. But now, the carefully crafted image of Camelot is deeply in trouble.
We have at this time David Kennedy. Give him some room, guys. Give him some room.
Michael Kennedy's grave is at the foot of his grandfather's.
Robert Kennedy Jr. pleaded guilty to possession of heroin.
One quoted Skakel saying, "I'm going to get away with murder.
I'm a Kennedy.
There has been murder. There's been assassinations. There's been untimely deaths. This family has been the epitome of scandal.
If ever the Kennedy brand is in need of a rebirth, it's now. And John Kennedy Jr. is the answer.
It's very good to be the son of a legend.
It's complicated.
Starting your own brand from scratch is probably impossible if your name is John Kennedy Jr. He wasn't going to change his name. He was who he was, and he was obviously proud of that. But how do you take a brand to the next level is the marketing question that he was really struggling with.
That's, I think, part of the puzzle to figure out in my life.
To reverse the entitled, indulgent image the family has earned, John recognizes he's in charge of crafting a new 21st century Camelot.
I have a pretty normal life, surprisingly.
Photo ops capture him rollerblading through New York City, rather than relying on town cars and limos, and riding the subway on his way to his $40,000 a year job as an assistant district attorney. Previous generations of Kennedys would relish the press John receives, but he's not content to leave it in the hands of others. Instead, John moves to take control of his image through his own magazine, named George.
Ladies and gentlemen, meet George.
The way he explained it was George Magazine was about the nexus of politics and celebrity.
There was an opportunity here to change the definition of a political magazine.
It wasn't really filling a market niche in terms of pure journalism, but it was filling a market niche in terms of a magazine edited by John F. Kennedy Jr.
It's selling very well.
Yeah.
The explosive success of its first issue fuels speculation that John will soon use George as a stepping stone for political office.
Do I have a burning desire to jump in the public arena? Not right yet. I'm doing this.
I'm telling you right now, John would have been governor of New York in a second, and then he would have been president.
But of all the decisions John makes, none signal the new 21st century Camelot more than his choice for the next Mrs. Kennedy. October 1996, 16 days after their secret storybook wedding, John and his new bride, Carolyn Bessette, return to New York and a throng of paparazzi.
We're not getting it, John.
Months earlier, America hails Carolyn as their Cinderella. But a series of incidents prior to the wedding, including a lover's quarrel in Central Park, change Carolyn's image. She's called high maintenance, ungrateful, not fit for the Prince of Camelot.
The other Kennedys get upset about that. What is our John getting into? But the bottom line was, they don't know what she was going through.
As if to punish Carolyn, the scrutiny intensifies. Camelot's no longer in even John's control. And the myth now exacts its own revenge. All Carolyn can do is duck and cover as any sign of weakness explodes into gossip. Carolyn is unhinged. She is snorting coke. She is having an affair.
It was massive, and that was nothing she signed on for.
Look, if you don't want to be surrounded by 1,000 paparazzis, you can do like George Clooney and get a place in Lake Como. They sure could have afforded it. You don't have to live that life.
But the truth is, that life is inescapable, ever since Joe Kennedy made it so. John has spent a lifetime trying to reinvent it, modernize it. But for his wife, Carolyn, the Kennedy brand is a prison, surrounded by walls of paparazzi and reporters.
It's a blessing if you want to live a successful public life. It's a curse if you want to live a peaceful private life.
By July 1999, John's life is at a crossroads. Sales of George Magazine are crumbling, and so too is his marriage. Carolyn is blamed for both. If anyone can resolve it, perhaps it is John. But the world will never know.
When I turned on Fox News and I saw the name Kennedy and it said plane missing, and that's all I had to see. That was New York City's first 9/11. I can't think of anything else that brought that city to its knees.
I didn't think that that would happen to him, of all people. He seemed really grounded and didn't think that he would be caught in the tragedies of the Kennedys.
With him went the mystique. With him went the whole Kennedy aura. We'll talk about it and read about it forever, but it's done.
Time and new media have warped the Kennedys' ability to control their brand and image. Their egos, appetites, and flaws now too fully exposed, leaving many to wonder if the only thing keeping them in the headlines is scandal.
Joe came out to Hollywood. That's a success story. But what accompanied that was this lack of morality and these I can do anything I want to, and I don't have to play by the rules mentality, and that cost the Kennedy family dearly.
Hollywood Scandals comes from the Dark Hollywood Collection at Reels Channel. To get more like this when you watch TV, go to Reels.com. That's R-E-E-L-Z.com. Check the top of your screen and enter your zip code to find us on your system. You'll also find extras from the latest Real Crime programs that are only on Reels. Find Hollywood Scandals and its companions on Roku and Fire TV, too.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.